Ragtime to Rock and Roll. Music, 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 in which Kenneth Moore finds that the Pacific was terrific after all. He also observes a falling star, but discovers a whole rising galaxy revolving round a new A&R man of the first magnitude. He learns how one of the stars was named and why. He watches the first moves in a treasure hunt and is shown a chart which indicates where the gold was buried.
Last week, we dealt with what somebody must surely have referred to as the new look in records, the LP and the 45. Anything that was different was described as new look in the late 1940s, for we still hadn't got over the new look itself, that first extravagant post-war crop of Paris fashions. But if fashion had plunged deliriously into peace, politics had not. The Cold War, that sullen hostility between East and West, was at its chilliest. Occasionally, it threatened to warm up, like when the Russians blockaded West Berlin in 1948. Once, it actually became a hot war, for the long tragedy of Korea began in 1950. The big nations tested their atomic bombs like quarrelsome men ostentatiously sharpening knives. When the times were not actively alarming, they were highly confusing. The confusion, if not the alarm, seemed to have spilled over into the smaller world of popular music, where there was a great deal of activity, but no discernible sense of direction. We now know, of course, that it was getting ready for the next big stylistic revolution. In 1949, however, as we heard last week, the biggest thing in popular entertainment wasn't revolutionary at all, except in the magnitude of its success. South Pacific.
We got sunlight on the sand, we got moonlight on the sea, we got mangoes and bananas you can pick right off the tree,
we got volleyball and ping pong and a lot of dandy games.
What ain't we got?
We ain't got games.
We get packages from home,
we get movies, we get shows,
we get speeches from our skipper
and advice from Tokyo Rose,
we get letters doused with perfume,
we get dizzy from the smell.
What don't we get?
You know damn well.
We have nothing to put on a clean white suit for.
What we need is what there ain't no substitute for.
There is nothing like a day, nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name that is anything like a day.
There's nothing like a dame. And in the late 1940s, there was nothing like the success of South Pacific. As a stage musical, it was an enormous hit. And once again, the prime movers of sensation were Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein. Together with Joshua Logan, they took James A. Michener's collection of stories, Tales of the South Pacific, and with the same instinctive expertise that had created Oklahoma 6 years earlier, came up with another of those successes which take your breath away to contemplate. There are no evening classes in musical writing because it's not something you can learn. But here's Richard Rogers imparting at least some of the know-how.
You'd get two people like Cable, the young lieutenant, and the native girl, Liat, a very young, rather naive people. The girl, tremendously innocent. And if you wanted these two people to sing, I think that what you would give them to sing would necessarily have the feeling of youth and innocence. Mm-hmm. Here's an example of what I mean. Childlike. We both felt that this is essential to the dramatic validity of these characters, especially in the situation in which we found them.
I touch your hand and my arms grow strong, like a pair of birds that burst with song. My eyes look down at your lovely face, and I hold the world in my embrace. Younger than springtime are you, softer than starlight are you, warmer than winds of June are the gentle lips you gave me. Gayer than laughter are you, sweeter than music are you, angel and lover, heaven and earth are you. When your youth and joy invade my arms and fill my heart as now they do, then younger than springtime am I, gayer than laughter.
Younger Than Springtime, from the original cast album of South Pacific. The two leading roles were taken by the opera singer Ezio Pinza as De Beck and Mary Martin as Nellie Forbush. This is how Mary Martin and her big song were introduced to each other after a telephone call from Richard Rogers.
We went over, and it was about midnight. He was playing it on the piano, and Oscar sang it in his darling, darling voice. And Richard Rogers, who has the most divine rhythm, the most perfect rhythm beat, and he played it for Oscar. And then I said, could I have the lyrics? Could I look at it? And could I sing it now? So I sat down beside Richard, and he played it, and I sang it. I don't read music. I hear a song once, and I know it. And I sang it, and I sang it at the top of my voice at the end. And when I finished, I fell off the piano bench. And Richard Rogers turned to me and looked at me on the floor, and he said, never sing it any other way. That's the way I want. I'm in love with a wonderful guy's son. The telephone rang, and it was in the River House, which is a very swank place in New York. The telephone rang, and the manager said, you are disturbing the neighbors around you in this house, in this apartment. Please pull it down. And Richard Rogers turned to Oscar and said, wait until they have to pay $9.90 to hear this song sung.
I expect every one of my crowd to make fun of my proud protestations of faith and romance. And they'll will say I'm naive as a babe to believe every fable I hear from a person in pants. Fearlessly I'll face them and argue their doubts away. Loudly I'll sing about flowers in spring. Lastly I'll stand on my little flat feet and say, love is a grand and a beautiful thing. I'm not ashamed to reveal the world a famous feeling I feel. I'm as corny as Kansas in August. I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in the conventional dither with the conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as trite and as gay as a daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night, pouring light on the dew. I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July. If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love with a wonderful guy.
Mary Martin, on a tidal wave of success caused by South Pacific. From the original cast LP, the album which confirmed the wisdom of making such records. LPs of complete shows have since introduced musical productions to far more people than have ever actually seen them in the theatre, and have also coaxed into the theatre others who might never have gone otherwise. The success of these LPs even persuaded record companies to become major backers of stage productions themselves for a time. While the artistic and material fortunes of Rodgers and Hammerstein were now almost unassailable, those of another man, whose initial success had been far more spectacular than theirs, began, unbelievably, to falter.
Yeah, like I said, that knowledge can mess up your life at times.
Oh, it makes you so nervous. I shot a blank. Now, what's with you, Frank?
Well, dig me. I started to school just like all kids do.
You mean you were young once?
I was a Mickey Rooney of my day. Learned my lessons and got along fine.
A little old social climber.
And then as time went on, I learned a lot of other things.
You clever boy.
And I really had myself a jolly time.
I can imagine as much.
I never played any favorites, because I was much too smart.
You think you were too smart. Where did you get
had
further down?
Had my boots on, and I had them laced up tight.
Kids talk like that in your era.
We wrote the book, Pearl, but then I made a mistake.
Most men do.
I should have known from the start.
Most men don't.
Let me tell you what happened last night.
This is not dated material.
Stand back, because it started with a gal.
Always does.
And her name, it was Sal.
Sounds corny.
Oh, she was cute. She was as fine as a bird on the wing.
You always could pick them. But you were much too bright to fall in love the first night.
But a little learning is a dangerous thing.
I told you that on the other side of the record.
Frank Sinatra's biographer, Arnold Shaw, dates the start of Sinatra's late 40s decline from some point as far back as 1947, when one of those unaccountable and at the time almost imperceptible shifts in public taste was happening. That Sinatra himself had some inkling of it, he deduces from the making of that record, which was a move away from the lush balladry of the mid-40s. It was made in the hectic last months of 1947, when the record companies, like housewives laying in foods at the rumor of a shortage, were stocking up in preparation for the second musician's strike. This salting down operation called for a punishing recording schedule. playing havoc with Sinatra's already failing health and strained voice. As if that wasn't enough, he was starting to receive bad notices for his films, and worst of all, to draw lukewarm responses from live audiences and unenthusiastic reviews from record critics. Lost in the Stars, said Downbeat magazine in late 1949, seems pitched too low for Sinatra, nor is he able to make the rather complex lyric hang together. On the simple Old Master Painter, he fares better. A hit song, though Sinatra's is not the best record.
The Old Master Painter from the faraway hills painted the violets and the daffodils. He put the purple in the twilight haze, then did a rainbow for the rainy days. Dreamed up the murals on the blue summer skies, painted the devil in my darling's eyes. Captured the dreamer with a thousand thrills, the old master painter from the faraway hills. Then came his masterpiece, and when he was through, he smiled down from heaven and he gave me you. What a beautiful job on that wonderful day, the old master painter from the hills far away.
Troubles in his personal life, the vindictiveness of much of the American press, and the simple biological fact that his first Bobby Sox fans had grown older were probably all contributing factors to the slump in Sinatra's career. Whatever the causes, the slump was real enough. The readers of the jazz magazine Downbeat, less prone, it's hoped, to the fickleness of ordinary fans, placed him fifth in their 1949 poll, after years of carrying him to the top by a wide margin. The voice they favored for first place that year was this one.
The night like a lovely tune, beware my foolish heart, how white the ever constant moon. Take care my foolish heart, there's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss. Her lips are much too close to mine. Beware, my foolish heart. But should our eager lips combine, then let the fire start. For this time it isn't fascination or a dream that will fade and fall apart. It's love, this time it's love, my foolish heart.
Billy Eckstein, who ousted Frank Sinatra from the top of the male singer category in Downbeat's 1949 poll. Frank Sinatra himself put a great deal of the blame for his decline onto the new artist and repertoire man at American Columbia Records, though in fairness it has to be pointed out that the decline was in evidence before Miller's appearance. If the term had been invented at the time, Mitch Miller would have been described as a whiz kid, an ex-oboe player, and a very good one too. He revealed a flair for producing hit records on his own terms.
Now, Sinatra, when I came to Columbia, Columbia Records advanced him about $150,000. The then president, Wallerstein, came to me and said, Mitch, I want you to be sure and earn that money back for us. So I want you to give him the best songs. I said, well, I'll do my best. And I found two songs. One was called The Roving Kind, and the other one's called My Heart Cries for You. Sinatra's on his way to see Ava in Africa. Ava Gardner, that is. And I called him up and I said, I want you to stop off in New York. I know your keys. I will have two songs ready for you. We go right into the studio and we'll make them, and then you go take the plane out that night. And said, fine. I had the arrangements made, had the chorus hired, the orchestra hired, and I met him 7 o'clock in the morning on the Los Angeles plane. He came to the office. He came with two of his henchmen, and they listened to these two songs, and they looked at each other. And I don't know what mood Frank was in. I, God knows, in those days. Any day, actually. And he said, I wouldn't do any of that crap. So here I was with a studio scheduled, the musicians hired, who had to be paid whether they worked or not. And in the back of my head, I said, well, I'll show them. I'll get hold of Guy Mitchell. Well, I tracked him down, spent the day practicing, rehearsing with him, went in at 5 o'clock, and made those two sides. And overnight, not only did both of those songs become number one songs, but Guy Mitchell became a top artist.
Mitchell was not merely unknown when he made that record. He wasn't even Guy Mitchell. Bob Merrill, later to become famous as a lyric writer for the show Funny Girl, worked in those days in close association with Mitch Miller and remembers the rechristening ceremony.
Guy Mitchell was really found on the street in front of the building that houses all the publishers, and he was well known as a demonstration recording artist. But he had never had a song recorded by Columbia or Victor, any one of the big companies. And he was just brought in fast because the orchestra was sitting there when Sinatra walked out, and he went in and did the vocals. And his name was Al Cernick. And on the way out, Mitch Miller said to him, I don't think your name is a very good name for a hit singer. Let's think up a name to put on the label. And Guy couldn't think. So Mitch Miller said, well, let's see, you're a nice guy, and my name is Mitchell. So let's call you Guy Mitchell. And that's the way Guy Mitchell was named.
Well, that's a funny thing, you know, your parents from the old country and change your name. You know, like, I don't envy anyone. I'm just happy being me. I'm happy for people. But you wouldn't want to wake up being someone else, would you?
Guy Mitchell, otherwise Al Cernick, on a problem of identity. No such problems confronted Mitch Miller, a man who knew precisely who he was, where he was going, and how to get there.
I was given the job of running Columbia in 1950, they had nobody there. So when I took over, Goddard Lieberson gave me complete freedom. Now, we could have gone to other companies and raided them and gotten artists who were already successful. That didn't appeal to my ego, and not only that, making a record is a peculiar business. You cannot convince an artist, if he doesn't believe in the song that he's doing, you can't take him by the ear and say, you got to sing this song or else your contract is null and void. I mean, they have you by the short hairs every time. So I said, I would like to find all new people, which I proceeded to do.
Jezebel. Thank you.
devil was born. Without a pair of horns, it was you. Jezebel, it was you. If ever an angel fell, Jezebel, it was you. Jezebel, it was you. If ever a pair of eyes promised paradise, deceiving me, grieving me, leaving me blue, Jezebel, it was you. If ever the devil's plan was made to torment man, it was you.
Jezebel, recorded in 1951 by Frankie Lane, new to the Columbia label, brought across by Mitch Miller from his old record company, Mercury. Those were the days when the A&R man, the artists and repertoire manager, was nearly a dictator. Competition for the nation's ear, or to be more blunt, its wallet, was fierce, and an A&R man like Mitch Miller was constantly on the lookout for material that was new enough to tickle the public's fancy, yet not so strange as to put people off.
Well, I took songs from everywhere. I mean, I was the first to take Hank Williams songs. I'll never forget with Tony Bennett in 1950. He was a brand new artist. His first record was a Boulevard of Broken Dreams, which he had used as an audition for me. And it made a lot of noise, sold a few, quite respectable, in fact. But when I brought this song and I played the Hank Williams song, and I listened to the song, and it was closing two lines, "Why don't you free my doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?" You know, that to me was the essence of popular songwriting, in very few words to say a lot. And here was this country singer. He had very little education, but he wrote from the guts. And I played his record to Tony, and with a scratching violin. "And why don't you hear?" And Tony heard it. He says, "Are you kidding?" He says, "You want me to do cowboy songs?" I said, "Now, wait a minute. You know, I got Percy Faith to make the arrangement." Of course, that was Cold, Cold Heart. And that was the breakthrough.
I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Another love before my time made your heart sad and blue. And so my heart is paying now for things I didn't do. In anger, unkind words are said that make the teardrop start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
He was just great in the industry at the time because I liked his system of rotating the artists. He all gave them a shot. And there were the four lads and Rosemary Clooney and myself. And what we would do is we were trained to promote one another. Johnny Ray would be out talking about Tony Bennett, and Tony Bennett would talk about Rosie Clooney and the four lads. And we all had it was teamwork. It seems that wherever there is no dissension and nice involvement, that things seem to work.
Tony Bennett describing the benign side of Mitch Miller's control over his artists. Miller's use of what was still partly country repertoire is interesting, considering we're talking about over 20 years ago. But Mitch Miller, it was up to all sorts of things. Echo, on pop records, reached cathedral proportions in the later 50s, but there's some artificially created echo on nearly everything you hear on record nowadays. Again, the man who claims the credit or accepts the blame, according to how you look at it, is Mitch Miller.
The echo chamber, per se, was invented by Bob Fine, an engineer friend of mine, and me. In 1948, when I came in to do these records, I said, Bob, I can't stand it. Everyone sounds like they're singing through a hunk of wool. Can't we do something to put a halo around the voice? I'll never forget, he rigged up a loudspeaker and a microphone into a toilet and sent the signal in there and then mixed a little of it back with the original. And that did exactly what I wanted to. And, of course, that became an aberration later on when people caught on to it, because instead of using it as a tool, they used it as the overall content of the record. But what I was driving at is that made the singer more of a performer in the home where the record is to be heard, or in the car. So it was on the first record that I made with Vic Damone. It was either Again or You're Breaking My Heart. But the point was to make the performer sound more alive on the record.
Damone having his heart broken. And with that echo, apparently manufactured in a toilet, popular music moves one stage nearer to the civil engineering it is today. It's tentatively getting ready for the time when it will be neither the singer nor the song, but the sound. Les Paul and Mary Ford. And here's Chet Atkins, leading Nashville guitarist and producer, giving us some idea of how it was done.
He made all those records, multiple recordings, and he did it all on one machine, which drives everybody batty now. They can't believe he did it, but he did. He had the heads on the machine reversed. He had playback, erase, and record, I believe, instead of erase, record, and playback. He had them reversed. So anytime he had made a mistake, he had to do it all over. But he talked to Ampex, one of the manufacturers, into building an 8-track machine back there in the 50s. So that started our multiple recording techniques, you know. And then we got into 16 and 24 and 32. And every time I see him, I tell him I'm going to kick him, because he made about five times as much work for me and every other producer in the country.
Where there's heaven, high above, the darkest night would shine, you would come to
But while the production techniques were changing, the source of supply of popular music was still the professional composer and author working through Broadway, Hollywood, or the Tin Pan Alley network of publishers. As a matter of fact, Les Paul's own big success, How High the Moon, was the sole survivor from a vanished musical of 1940. And here we are, at the start of the 50s, finding a subtly different, perhaps significant stage musical, nonetheless, full of our story's raw material.
When you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can't bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten the Taj Mahal, call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some dough. When you see a Joe saving half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some dough. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, it's a cinch that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum Balderal, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12-7 that the guy's only doing it for some doll.
Stubby Kaye, Johnny Silver, and the original Broadway cast of Guys and Dolls. Frank Lesser's source for Guys and Dolls were the writings of Damon Runyon. Lesser had begun as a lyric writer as long ago as 1931, but his most famous single song was probably Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Here is his widow, the singer and actress Jo Sullivan, talking about the impact of Guys and Dolls.
Guys and Dolls was an instant success. All the Broadway characters and the language that he used, the Runyon language and the whole Broadway characters, I think that was it. And the look of the show, again, was a very different look. It wasn't pretty, and it was terribly funny. It was the choral things, and when the three men would sing together and have the counterpoint work, that always gave him great, great pleasure. And a good rhyme. He adored it when he really had a good rhyme. It's great fun.
I've never been in love before. It's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is love that's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour.
So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in. I've really never been in love.
His style was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and riding until 8:30 in the morning. Then he would have a martini, and he would have breakfast and take a nap and get up about 12, stay up a few more hours and then take another short nap and then stay up till 12 o'clock at night. You never knew when he was going to work, but he always was up 4 o'clock in the morning because he said nobody could bother him at that time. It was completely quiet. And he had a piano, electric piano, with the earphones, which he always rode on so he wouldn't wake up the entire neighborhood. And that he always did. He loved his morning to himself.
I dreamed last night I got on the boat to heaven, and by some chance I had brought my dice along. And there I stood, and I hollered, someone paid me. But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. and the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down. You're rocking the boat. I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance found a bottle in my fist, and there I stood nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, beware, you're on a heavenly trip.
Beware.
People all said, beware,
beware,
you scuttle a ship. And the devil will drag you under with a soul so heavy you'd never float. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
Sit down, you're rocking, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking the boat.
Stubby K, once again from the Broadway cast album of Guys and Dolls, and before that, Joe Sullivan talking about the work and the working methods of her late husband, Frank Lesser, the man who put the emphasis back on comedy in the musical theater. Now, so far today, the music has been exclusively American, and that's a fairly accurate reflection of where the power lay in popular music. But that doesn't mean that nothing could cross the Atlantic the other way at all. And both Mantovani and the company he recorded for believed that they could establish themselves with the American record-buying public. Monty knew, everybody calls him Monty, Monty knew that there was no point in trying to beat the Americans at their own game.
Ronald Binge, you know, who's a great composer these days himself, was a scoring for me at the time, and he thought it would be a good idea. The only thing they don't use is their strings. So I had a fight with the Decca company to give me a chance to use really mess of strings, because it's only a mess of strings that gives you a certain sound. Well, it took me a hell of a long time to convince Decca to try because of the expense of, as usual. And I said, all right, well, if you've got a really good idea, have a go. So we sat down and chose the titles, and Ronnie did the scores for them. I remember being in the studio at that time when eventually, after going through four or five of the people, it was a very nice sound. We were pleased with the sound of what was coming out. And then Charmaine was played. Now, I had looked at the score now before we played it, you see, and I thought, there's a hell of a lot of discords in this piece. I don't know what Ronnie's up to. And he explained, he said, we're trying something else out. And when we played it, it really sounded beautiful. And the whole of the orchestra were delighted with it. And when an orchestra's delighted, I start worrying. It's too good as a rule. It's musicians' music. And musicians look at things totally different, shall we say, from a commercial venture. And this happened to be a commercial venture from Decca people with the price of the orchestra put in front of me every 2 seconds. Anyhow, we all loved it, and I thought it was really quite beautiful. It was an unusual sound, and then brought the record out, and they sent it to America.
Mantovani made the record of Charmaine, but the man who exported it to America was the chairman of Decca, Sir Edward Lewis.
Charmaine was picked up by a disc jockey in Cleveland, disc jockey Bill Randall. He pounded this record until it became a hit in the Cleveland area, and from there it extended throughout America. And on the strength of that impact, Mantovani became one of the biggest sellers ever hit the American market. selling something in the order of 20 million long-playing records.
Charmaine was introduced in America in 1951. The following year, another British artist had another massive hit on both sides of the Atlantic. In fact, it was the first time an English performer had ever topped the American charts. This was Vera Lynn with Auf Wiedersehen. And a story goes with it, as Sir Edward Lewis recalls.
The story of Auf Wiedersehen was that our recording director, Frank Lee, bought the recording up one day and put it on with great pride. And it struck me straight away that this was a hit, could be a hit. I suggested two things. One, that he should cut a piece of verse out in the middle and make it shorter. And two, that he should make it louder. So it would have been played in a car in America, and somebody else's car next door down Fifth Avenue maybe would hear the sound. And it's what happened. We shipped some hundreds of thousands to America. By the time I got there, and I picked one of the records up and I found that it didn't bear any resemblance to our own recording. I was told that they'd run out of English imported records. They'd had it pressed by one of the major American companies and that they couldn't do anything about to improve it. So I rang up the engineer and told him that it may be that his recording is better than ours, but we wanted the record to have the same sound as we had put on.
Don't let the tears drop.
It was probably Vera Lynn's very Englishness, singing a German title, admittedly, that made that record top the American charts as well as the British. And with that statement, we are knowingly guilty of inaccuracy, for there were no charts of the sales of records in Britain until later on in the year that Orfida's End came out. Andy Gray is now managing editor of New Musical Express, in which the first British sales chart appeared, and he gives us the background of it.
The New Musical Express was bought in 1952 by Morris Kinn, who used to run bands. He used to be with Joe Loss, and he would promote concerts. And the paper itself was flagging because it had been up to that time for dance band musicians, and it hadn't very much advertising, and it wasn't a commercial proposition. So he decided that the best thing to do was to turn it into a record paper, and the first thing he did was to take the charts from Billboard, the American magazine, and run those, and also he got from the British side the best-selling music charts, because the publishers didn't mind giving you figures on that. However, the recording people wouldn't give you figures, so we devised a system, or he devised a system, by asking retailers how many records they were selling, and to give a list. And the first chart appeared October the 7th, 1952, in the New Musical Express, and it only had 12. It was a top 12. The first top was Al Martino, was Here in My Heart. And that must have been a very good record, because it lasted for more than 2 months at the top of the chart. First British lady to get in was Vera Lynn with Forget Me Not. One or two others was Max Bygraves with Carl Punch's Cantata. And I also noticed Winifred Atwell, of course, Britannia Rag. And Winnie, of course, had a great run of about 3 years, in which she had a million seller with Let's Have a Party, as you probably remember. Mantovani was in with White Christmas. Then, of course, there were all the Americans, Guy Mitchell with Feet Up, and Rosemary Clooney Half As Much, Bing Crosby. We had Joe Stafford, Nat King Cole, Frankie Lane. Frankie Lane made a rather good duet with Doris Day called Sugar Bush.
Oh, we never not gonna go home. We won't go, we won't.
Didn't you let your mother know? Sugar Bush, I love you so.
Sugar Bush, what can I do? Mother's not so pleased with you. Promise me you will be true, and I'll come along with you.
Oh, we never not gonna go home. We won't go, we won't go. We never not gonna go phone, 'cause mother isn't home. Sugar Bush, come dance with me, and let the other fellas be. Just dance the polka merrily. Sugar Bush, come dance with me.
Oh, we never not gonna go home. We won't go, we won't go. Oh, we never not gonna go home, 'cause mother isn't home.
Oh, chocolate, you are so sweet. Yes, yes, you I'd like to eat. If I do, oh, what a treat. Chocolate, you are so sweet.
Oh, Sugar Bush, I love you so, and I will never let you go.
Now don't you let my mother know.
Sugar Bush, I love you so.
Sugar Bush, I love you so.
If you cast your mind back to the list of artists that Andy Gray read out just now from those early record charts, you get an impression that it was a time of variety amounting almost to confusion. We'll pursue that thought next week, but meanwhile, we leave you with Andy Gray.
Anybody could get in, and did, because you went from Mario Lanza, Mantovani, in the same way as Johnny Ray. Of course, the great thing was the Palladium. Everything revolved around the Palladium. There was Sunday night at the London Palladium as well, so that the stars were brought over from America, and Johnny Ray, Guy Mitchell, even Frank Sinatra in 1950, of course, before he made From Here to Eternity and went up again. The great thing was that they went on Sunday night at the London Palladium, and then they started to sell records. But the most important thing that happened about this period was the 45 record coming in, which was much cheaper to produce, much lighter, much easier to store, and it didn't break like these 78s used to. So consequently, this was probably the most important thing, combined with the fact that suddenly the people were buying better record players and becoming more conscious of hi-fi, and it was a great era. I can't remember if we had enough money to buy them in those days, but we bought them anyway.
If you love me half as much as I love you, you wouldn't worry me half as much as you do. You're nice to me when there's no one else around. You only build to let me down. If you miss me half as much as I miss you, you wouldn't stay away half as much as you do. I know that I would never be this blue. If you only love me half as much as I love you.
Ragtime to Rock and Roll was narrated by Kenneth Moore and written by Peter Clayton. The research was by Bill Sullivan, and the producer was John Billingham. Next week, in There's Gold in Them, Their Hits, Kenneth Moore goes prospecting in earnest, but finds that you can also stay at home and find an imitation gold almost indistinguishable from the real thing.